Hello and welcome to Animal Voices. You're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM. I am your host, Lauren Corman, here with Carl Orzechowski, bringing us the news and teching for us today. We have an exciting show coming up. We have an in-studio guest, which is always really exciting. We're graced by the presence of Dr. Matthew Brower, who is the curator of the University of Toronto Arts Centre and also a lecturer of museum studies. And it's my great pleasure to have him here. I'll just get him to say maybe hello, a quick hello. We're going to do some news first, but then we'll come back and talk about Matt's interpretations, engagements with wildlife photography and thinking through all the different ethical, political, epistemological issues that relate to wildlife photography. He's done really interesting work on camera shooting. We'll find out what that is, camera hunting, and questions surrounding masculinity and the gaze. So it'll be a great show. We'll come back with Matt after we hear from Carl.
Thanks, Lauren. The first piece of news coming to us is actually an announcement from a local group. Please join ARC2, the Animal Rights Collective, on Saturday, August 23rd from 2:30 p.m. to 6 p.m. at Woodbine Park in Toronto to support their campaign to stop Shoppers Drug Mart from selling shark cartilage. Members, volunteers, and local activists will be in attendance to present signs with facts versus fiction regarding the use of shark cartilage for cancer prevention. And they will have petitions to be signed to help stop the selling of shark cartilage by Shoppers Drug Mart. So it's happening Saturday, August 23rd, 2008. The location is Woodbine Park, which is at Coxwell and Lakeshore near the beach. The time is from 2:30 p.m. to 6 p.m. The event website is www.uncoverthecure.org. There's also an online petition and some online contacts. If you want to look up more information, you can join the ARC2 group on Facebook. That's ARK2 on Facebook, or you can probably check out their main website for the info. A little bit more about the press release. Shoppers Drug Mart sells two products of shark cartilage capsules for the treatment of cancer, arthritis, and joint pain. There's no scientific basis for the use of shark cartilage, and over 100 million sharks are killed annually as part of the industry. And they end their release with a quote from Gary K. Ostrander, research professor of biology and comparative medicine at the Johns Hopkins University. He says, quote, "Crude shark cartilage is marketed as a cancer cure on the premise that sharks don't get cancer. That's not true, and the fact that people believe it is an illustration of just how harmful the public's irrationality can be. It is worth noting that despite more than a decade of evaluation of shark cartilage, not a single controlled clinical study has established that it works as an anti-cancer agent." So again, please contact ARC2 for more information and to RSVP so that they can provide enough signs for the event. And the second piece of news coming to us from CBC News. The headline is "Humpback Whale on the Comeback Trail, Say Conservationists." The humpback whale, for four decades the poster child of the conservation movement, is no longer considered a high risk for extinction, a leading environmental group said Tuesday. The International Union for Conservation of Nature, which each year produces a red list of threatened species, has moved the humpback whale's status from vulnerable to least concern. The Switzerland-based IUCN did the same for the southern right whale. Humpbacks and southern right whales are making a comeback in much of their range, mainly because they have been protected from commercial hunting, said Randall Reeves, an expert with the IUCN Species Survival Commission, specializing in cetaceans, the group of aquatic mammals that includes whales, dolphins, and porpoises. Quote, "This is a great conservation success and clearly shows what needs to be done to ensure these ocean giants survive," he said in a statement. The humpback whale population dropped to the low thousands before it was banned from commercial hunts in 1966. Its population has now risen to at least 60,000, according to Bill Perrin, the chair of the IUCN Cetacean Red List Authority. The IUCN said many smaller cetaceans are still under threat, however, with more than a quarter still considered threatened and two species and 12 subpopulations listed as critically endangered. The vaquita, a porpoise native to the Gulf of California off the coast of Mexico, is most likely the next species to go extinct, the group said. Only an estimated 150 of the porpoises are alive in the wild, and fishing gill nets are killing about 15% of the population every year. Quote, "Too many of these small coastal cetaceans end up as bycatch in fisheries," said Reeves. "This remains the main threat to them, and it is only going to get worse." The IUCN Red List includes around 41,000 species and subspecies from around the world. The review is part of a larger survey of the world's mammals, due to be released in October at the IUCN World Conservation Congress in Barcelona. And finally, the last piece of short news before we get to the interview. This is coming to us from the Verein gegen Tierfabriken, or the Association Against Animal Factories in Austria. As we've been following the story for the past couple of months, close to a dozen activists were imprisoned on no charges and continually held on no charges by the Austrian government. But a little bit of good news this week, as one animal protectionist was released from remand. Following a successful appeal from his lawyer, the wrongly imprisoned animal protectionist artist from Tirol was released today from remand in WR Neustadt. Chris Moser suffered extreme anxiety and depression due to the separation from his wife and three children. The remand judge lifted the remand as the quote-unquote risk of reoffending was no longer present. However, the public prosecutor has already appealed against the judge's decision in an attempt to further separate Chris from his family. A decision is expected in 2 weeks, but meanwhile, at least Chris and his family are reunited. The other 9 innocent animal protectionists remain in custody. This is the first indication that the House of Cards construed as a criminal organization is beginning to fall apart, said Harold Balak of the Association Against Animal Factories. So a little bit of good news coming from there. It's been a long 2 months for those activists, and I'm glad to hear that at least one of them is out.
Great. Thanks, Carl. Welcome back to the program, Animal Voices, CIUT 89.5 FM. Today, we are very lucky to have an in-studio guest. We're here with Dr. Matthew Brower, who's the curator of the University of Toronto Art Centre and a lecturer of museum studies. And we're going to be talking specifically about wildlife photography and some of the research that he's done in that area. He's a bit of a historian. I don't know if you consider yourself that way, if that's your...
I think
one
I'm
of your titles.
Historian of visual culture, historian of photography. Yeah.
Okay. So although we're going to focus on wildlife photography, I was wondering if you could just give people an overview of some of your interests right now, or maybe some of the questions that you've been exploring right now, just to give it a better sense of who you are as a scholar.
Okay. Well, I'm just finishing a book for the University of Minnesota that covers, I guess, what we're going to be talking about today on early wildlife photography, kind of looking at how photography has changed the way people think about animals. I'm also working on a book for Reaction as part of their animal series on a cultural history of butterflies.
Oh, wow. Great. So butterflies. Why butterflies?
It comes out of some of the research I was doing in terms of trying to think about animal appearance and about butterfly wings, their connection to art, and what that might get us to think about how it means to represent animals. If animals already have, like butterfly wings, something that they're representing.
Mm. Okay. So why have you been so drawn to questions of visual culture? Why should we bother engaging with that set of issues?
Well, I think that, to be blunt, most of us encounter most species in representation. Hmm. We gain our knowledge of wild animals largely through photographs, videos, television programs. And we often tend to think, you know, we understand that the editing in programs and wildlife films is perhaps a bit deceptive, but we tend to, I think, not take as seriously the construction of wildlife photographs. It just looks like we've captured a moment of the animal in the wild, and, you know, that's it. It doesn't seem like there's as much editing or shaping. Mm. And I think my research, I came in with the same expectation, that I would go back and I would find, well, who was the first person to take a wildlife photograph, and that would be the first person who took a camera into the woods and took a picture of an animal. Mm. And what I actually found was that wasn't the case, that wildlife photography was something that had to be constructed, that these people originally taking photographs didn't understand their photographs in the same way. Mm. And that made me realize that, you know, wildlife photographs are actually quite powerful in terms of the images of animals and of nature that they construct for us. So we have this sense that, you know, animals exist in some sort of deep nature, and they do their own things, and they're really only authentically wild animals when there are no humans around. or at least no modern humans. The photographs provide evidence of that. But, you know, the photographs are very tricky to produce. They're often quite intrusive. But none of that really makes it into, you know, the contemporary circulation of wildlife photographs.
I hate to ask academics these types of questions about sort of the productive value of their work, but is it thinking about these issues for the sake of thinking about engaging critically for its own sake, or does this help us get us somewhere in terms of revisioning our relationships with other animals?
Hopefully it has some impact that way. I think one of the things I would say is that these images are very compelling, and it's only when we take them seriously and start thinking about how they produce these effects that we can start understanding how they shape what we do. So I do think that hopefully my work will help us understand a little better of something about how we relate to animals, and that will help, you know, both politically and theoretically.
Can you give us a sense of a bit of an historical trajectory of the wildlife photography that you've looked at, and maybe bringing us up to the current moment? I know this is just an incredibly huge question, but some of the major nodes. And I'm especially thinking about wildlife photography now and how the notion of an image, I think, is changing pretty rapidly, given digital photography and the ability for really lay people to manipulate images in pretty highly contrived ways. But can you take us back and then bring us up to today?
Okay. So one of the first people I've been looking at is John Dillwyn Llewellyn, who's a Welsh photographer, who's a cousin of Fox Talbot, the English inventor of, I guess, one form of photography. And in the 1850s, Llewellyn was making these images, which we might think of as very strange, where he was taking taxidermic animals and positioning them in the woods around his estate and taking pictures of them. So that they, to I think a modern eye, they kind of look like faked wildlife photographs. That he couldn't actually take pictures of animals in the woods, and so he was trying to substitute by putting stuffed animals in there. But I think thinking of it in terms of our contemporary understanding is a bit of a mistake, because what you need to have that sense of wildlife photography is a sense of the kind of authentic animal that only comes about through the further development of photography. So that at the time, these kind of lumpy deer looked realistic to the people of the time, because that was their understanding of what a deer really looked like. They were also much more interested in the symbolic aspects, so that, you know, the most popular and important painter at the time, or one of the most significant, was Edward Landseer, who paints these kind of very noble stags that are being hunted and, you know, standing like the king of the forest. And we tend to think of those now as being overly sentimentalized, as anthropomorphic, as projecting inappropriate values onto the animals. But at the time, they were seen as, you know, significant aesthetic achievements. So that, you know, I think most crucially is that they were lacking this concept of the wild animal, that there was some other space of nature that was completely foreign to humans, and that, you know, animals really belong there, and that the animals were somehow signs of that. So instead, there was this kind of sense of nature as place, and that these stuffed animals then are to evoke the sense of nature in a very different way. So then, you know, over the course of the 19th century, we see improvements in film technology. So Llewellyn's exposures were taking about 20 minutes to make. So, you know, clearly you couldn't get an animal to sit still, or certainly not a wild animal to sit still, for 20 minutes. Over the course of the 19th century, then we see, you know, photographs being taken in zoos, you know, people taking lots of photographs of pets, service animals, horses pulling carts, donkeys. But we don't really see a lot of, you know, live animals in nature until, you know, the 1870s, when we get one of the British expeditions taking photographs of penguins in Antarctica, again, because they don't move much. So you can get up close to them, they're nesting, right, you know, and take the picture.
So the technology itself is influencing how people are interacting with or portraying the animals.
Absolutely. You know, the limits of the technology determine the kinds of photographs you can take. Also in the 1870s, then we see Edward Muybridge's experiments trying to prove that horses have all their feet off the ground when they're running. And so it's that kind of development of photographic technology, which is in fact being driven by the desire to take pictures of animals. So animals aren't just some sideline to this development, but they're actually really central to it. That, you know, people could be made to sit still, they'd wear back braces, they would adjust themselves to the photographic technology because they really wanted to be photographed. But animals wouldn't. So we see Muybridge developing his technologies to capture images of the horse. Another German photographer, Ottmar Anschutz, developed the focal plane shutter in order to be able to take pictures of storks. The French physiologist Etienne Jules Marey developed basically the beginnings of the movie camera in order to be able to take, you know, sequential images of animals in motion to do physiological experiments, because he was an anti-vivisectionist who was concerned that working on dead animals didn't allow you to see the processes of life. And so he thought the camera and the ability to capture motion would enable, you know, you to study animals as they lived, as they moved. So there's a strong connection then to the development of animal imagery and the kinds of ways people could conceive of them. Then in the 1890s, we start to see the stuff that I'm really interested in, which is the development of camera hunting. So this is the point at which we now have roll film, amateur photography becomes possible. And we see a large number of Americans going into the woods with their cameras and trying to take pictures of animals. They thought of their photography as hunting, and they talked about their photographs as trophies. So they didn't see the camera as something that captured images of deep nature. They didn't see this as revealing a nature that was, you know, separate from humans. What they thought they were doing was capturing the moment of contact. So this was the equivalent to shooting the animal, was getting its photograph. Except that at the time, they said, it was actually more like hunting because it was more difficult. It was more sporting. You're carrying this very bulky camera. You have to get very, very close to the animal. And that was much more difficult than just learning how to shoot it with a rifle. So they started to publish their photographs in sporting journals, published how-to books talking about, you know, how other people could get involved. Theodore Roosevelt took up the advocacy of the practice, speaking about it as, you know, this was the solution to the problem of conservation. So he was concerned that the frontier was disappearing. All these hunters and market hunters were killing too much of the animals. There weren't going to be enough game animals left. And if there weren't enough game animals, then young American boys couldn't go out into the woods and hunt. And then they wouldn't turn into real men, because, of course, for Roosevelt, hunting was how men became men. And so he thought, well, if they can go out and photograph animals, and it's this difficult practice, and it calls on all the same kinds of resources, then here's a way of continuing to hunt while at the same time not actually killing all the animals.
So by putting photography, wildlife photography, in the frame of hunting, would you say that there was a shift in desire then in terms of what people were trying to achieve in that history that you've outlined for us? Was there a sort of a psychological or an emotional shift that happened in terms of the discourse of hunting at the time?
Yeah, this is taking place in the context of a broader shift in American hunting practice. So while hunting had always been presented as being this thing that Americans could do that English people weren't, right? So in England, if you were a commoner and you hunted, you know, you could get hung. In America, the idea was that everyone could hunt, that there was free game for the taking. But at the same time, hunting was seen as, up until the kind of middle of the 19th century, as a kind of lower class activity, that it was the, what you would do is if you couldn't do anything else. Whereas in the kind of the middle of the 19th century, we start to see the emergence of an aristocratic ideal around hunting, that hunting was about sportsmanship and about proving, you know, masculinity, virility, and that there needed to be an etiquette about how one hunted. One had to give the animals a sporting chance, all of this. And so it's because of that shift then that animal photography can be seen as hunting. Hunting isn't about producing animal bodies for food. It's about producing trophies to demonstrate one's abilities, one's success, one's prowess. And so the argument is, well, if hunting with a camera is more difficult than hunting with a rifle, then hunting with the camera will produce a much more solid demonstration of one's virility, prowess, masculinity.
Mm. How do questions of death then play into this? Because I'm wondering, well, one of the things that struck me about reading your work is I thought, well, this is a shift towards kind of a cleaner interaction with animals in some ways, but it wasn't always that people were camera hunting and not killing the animals. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about, I don't know who it is. I guess it's Donna Haraway that talks about the killability of animals. But this idea that hunting really is bound up with questions of life and death, and how does that get refigured then with this idea of camera hunting?
Well, okay, this is taking place as well in the context of the development of conservation and game laws. So one justification for camera hunting is that you go out and you bag your limit. And then instead of sitting around the camp all day, because you can't hunt anymore, you could still go out now with the camera and continue to hunt, except now you're not going to shoot things. But it was also that depending on the animal and how they were hunting it, they may or may not shoot the animal after they photographed it. For example, some of the early hunters, like camera hunters like the Wallahans, Alan Grant Wallahan and his wife Mary Wallahan from Colorado, they would hunt cougars down with dogs. They'd chase them with a pack of dogs, get the cougar up in a tree. So this is their way of immobilizing the animal so that they can set the camera up and take its picture. And then, of course, after they've photographed it, they'll shoot it. So for a number of these people, there isn't this sharp distinction between the camera means not killing the animal and, you know, the gun means killing the animal. For some of them, it's a mode of the two. At the same time, we see people, you know, experimenting with camera guns where they're trying to, you know, get an image of the animal at the moment it's being shot.
What's that about? How do you make sense of that?
I think for them that there's really something about the moment of the kill that, despite this rhetoric around camera hunting, that it's about the sport or the difficulty, and that's the real demonstration. I think for some people there really is this desire to kill, and that's really at the heart of why they're hunting, which is, you know, somewhat disturbing. But I think it's also important to tease this out, because understanding how these practices work allows us to unpack some of the claims. So what's interesting is that at the time, there were three classes of hunters. There were the aristocratic sport hunters. There were market hunters who were killing game for commercial meat markets or feather markets in the big cities of America. And there were what are known as pot hunters, people who were hunting as part of a subsistence practice. Now, one of the interesting things that's really happened is that the sport hunters got together with the conservationists at the end of the 19th century and enacted a series of laws, most importantly the Lacey Act of 1901, which made it illegal to transport game across state lines. And that eliminated the practice of market hunting. But that over the course of the 20th century, we've seen less and less social willingness to valorize sport hunting. And instead, we see much more practice shifting, where the only justification seems socially acceptable is that we hunt for the meat. Whereas at the time, in the 1890s, the idea that you were hunting for some sort of utilitarian reason would have seen that that meant you weren't a real sportsman. Hmm. You weren't a real hunter.
Well, I wanted to go back a little bit. You'd mentioned the two photographers that had chased the cougar up the tree, and you mentioned in one of your articles that in the story of that photograph, the wife's contribution to this particular picture, and I guess in the work in general, was completely erased, and this wasn't accidental.
Well, what happened was that the Wallahans published their first volume together in 1894, which is the first volume of, or book, you know, illustrated with photographs of wild animals. But that book took place before they got involved in the discourse of camera hunting. At that time, they saw their work as being something equivalent to what George Catlin was doing with the depiction of First Nations peoples. That is, these First Nations or these animals are bound to perish. They're going to disappear in the face of progress. And so what we're going to do then is we're going to document them so that our grandchildren will have some sense of what was there through pictures. Not in terms of actual conservation, but just in terms of we'll have a record. And what happens is that after the book gets published, Wallahan comes to the attention of the Eastern establishment, and they become interested in his work. And so it's then in 1895, the year after, that Cosmopolitan magazine publishes an article and interview with Wallahan about his work. And in that, yes, the article reframes his practice as camera hunting and completely erases the contribution of his wife. So that these are now Alan Grant's photographs, it's Alan Grant's practice, and Mary Wallahan disappears. I argue that that's in fact kind of necessary to the operations of camera hunting, that it be seen as a masculine practice. So the argument is that this is a difficult, virile practice, therefore, you know, the woman's significant contribution has to be erased in order for that to be more straightforwardly and easily constructed.
So is there an interplay then that you see between then masculinity? I guess this is a chicken and the egg type question, but is wildlife photography then become a key way that masculinity is constructed, or does sort of larger tropes around masculinity in the culture then feed back into and shape how wildlife photography happens?
Oh, it's definitely coming from a shift that's taking place in masculinity. So that earlier there was a different practice of masculinity that was known under the term manliness. And it was a much more reserved practice and was connected to more refined modes of behavior and aesthetic accomplishment and appreciation. So these are the transcendentalists and various, you know, Emersonian kind of figures in American thought. And what starts to happen towards the end of the 19th century is that model of manliness breaks down. And what we see instead is the emergence of a new kind of understanding of, you know, maleness in American culture that gets figured as masculinity. And so Roosevelt is, say, one of the key figures for this. So he was, you know, this East Coaster who, you know, was interested in art and science and went to Harvard. And so when he first got into politics in Albany, he got made fun of as this kind of over-refined sissy. And so what he did then is he moved himself to the American West, set himself up as a rancher, had himself photographed with a rifle wearing buckskins, and circulated accounts of his exploits as a hunter and a rancher in newspapers to the East Coast Press. So he recreated himself from this East Coast effect to this Western frontier hero through hunting. So that, you know, hunting then, you know, and this contact with nature came to be seen as this kind of site of the production of American masculinity. And so the idea was then that, that or the hope was, that wildlife photography or camera hunting could be a site for the production of masculinity, because they were running into this problem that, you know, the frontier is running out, animal species are disappearing, the bison are dwindling, you know, end up getting down to, you know, 100 head of bison left in the American West at one point. So they were becoming aware that this practice of American masculinity is not sustainable. And they're really, really concerned about this. You see books being published, speeches being made about the threat of degeneracy and over-civilization, that if this kind of hunting and outdoor life and contact with the frontier can't continue, then the worry is that American men will become soft and effeminate.
Mm. And so did that have to do then, breakdown of manliness that you talk about, and the loss of the frontier and the decimation of different animal species, did it have to do then with the rise of industrialization, and that really being seen then as the sort of domesticating, as you point to, the sort of civilizing force that needed to be rallied against?
Yes, very much so. So what you see then is Americans all of a sudden feeling disconnected from nature, and we get a rise of tourism and, you know, this promotion of hunting and other sorts of outdoor activities as a kind of tonic against the effects of civilization. You know, so that we see a reappraisal of someone like Thoreau. Mm-hmm. So that instead of it being about a complete rejection, the idea is, well, we can read Thoreau as saying we all need a little dose of wilderness every now and then to make us better people.
Hmm. And so is it sort of a transference then that happens between wildness and wildlife somehow intermingling with people's sense of themselves as being wild?
Yes, that's the point of the trophy performance, right? Is that it's this kind of sympathetic magic that I have captured or shot some big virile animal, and I am displaying its antlers in my house in a kind of public space, and that therefore people who can come in will see that I have the kind of virility and hardihood that can do something like this. So that it is exactly about having a physical object that demonstrates one's masculinity.
How does that tie then in? I mean, you've already gestured towards this with the frontier, but how does these discourses around wildlife photography then tie into the larger shifts that were happening in the historical moment in terms of colonial practice?
Well, I mean, I think one thing to say is, of course, that America is still a colonial entity. So that this, you know, all the stuff going on in America is, you know, kind of a colonial project. But this is also taking place, really develops in the beginnings of the 19th century in the practice of camera hunting in Africa. But there's an earlier history in kind of Edwardian photography of the display of photographs of dead animals, trophy animals that have been shot in Africa as a kind of assertion of colonial superiority and power, right? That the ability to kill large game animals, exotic animals, again, was seen as evidence of manliness and of European superiority. Mm. And so the circulation of the images was designed to do just that, to show this is what we can do, this is what we've accomplished.
Mm. How do you compare that with the rise of zoos and the notion of display in zoos and the imperial project that Britain had, or America, or whatever?
Well, there's definitely a link. So Roosevelt's big safari, which he took after he left the presidency in 1908-1909, was, you know, the justification for it was that he was hunting specimens for the Smithsonian. So he was producing animal bodies for display, scientific research purposes. So there is a connection there that says all, you know, these modes of display are linked. So the taxidermists, the hunters learn taxidermy from natural history, manuals. Many of the expeditions that are bringing back zoo animals are also collecting other kinds of specimens. And so what I think we're really seeing is a kind of merging of separate discourses, that there's this natural history, vivisectionist, you know, producing dead animal bodies as a way of producing knowledge discourse coming that's linked to biology, natural history. And there's an earlier discourse of animal bodies as spectacle around menageries that gets taken up in the formation of the modern zoos. You know, many of these are coming out of royal collections and earlier menageries, and saying, okay, well, there's a kind of production of on the one hand knowledge and on the other hand spectacle. And you know, say if we look at the London Zoo, we know that originally it was meant to be just for the members, the elite, the aristocrats, who were supposed to have a certain kind of ideal mode of contemplation of the animals, and this was a scientific space. So then, you know, slowly as it goes on, it gets opened up more and more to the general public and becomes in some ways a space of animal spectacle.
I find myself in these types of discussions or reading this type of work to really find myself almost in the reading enacting this idea of the animal as being completely objectified, passive, controlled, captured, and in some instances that you've been talking about, killed. Do you see, though, a potential for, in the interview with Akira Lippitt, we talked about the gaze and the possibility, certain moments when the animal looks back and there's a certain assertion of agency or subjectivity. Do you see that? Is there cracks in this at all, or am I misinterpreting this idea that the animal really does come to be seen as objectified through these practices?
Well, I think one important thing to stress is, of course, the resistance of the animal. You know, the reason why hunters are resorting to hunting practices in order to take photographs is that wild animals don't generally like to sit still, have you walk up close, set up a big apparatus pointed at them, and then shoot them. So there is the resistance of the animal body of just not appearing. As to this question of the looking, I think it's very complicated, because I think there is this desire that gets figured in wildlife images that one can have this exchange of glances with the animal and somehow feel that you can see it or it can look back at you. And I think there's something to that. But at the same time, I think the relationship of the gaze is much more complicated there. That, you know, many of these animals are protectively colored. That is to say that they're designed to not show up. And so I think that one of the things that wildlife photography does as it pulls, you know, you adjust the depth of focus, so you take animals that blend into their background and you pull them out of the background by making the background less in focus and flattening the space of the image, creates this sense that there is this ideal vantage point in nature, that if we were only, you know, the right kind of human beings and engaged in the right kind of practices, we could go out and have these kind of relations to animals, but that are really only available in the photograph. These are not vantage points that one can actually ever see. I think that's one of the more problematic aspects of it, which is that it creates this sense that animals' relation to visibility is such that they're just there. Instead, I think that they're engaged in this very complicated relation to visibility. On the one hand, they have practices of display where they are showing off their coloration and trying to attract attention. And on the other hand, they have practices of camouflage or concealment where they're disappearing into the background. And I think that suggests that their relationship to visuality is richer and deeper, and that there really isn't any point in nature at which we could sit and say that the animal is completely and obviously visible to us in the way that photography can encourage us to want to see.
Do you think that some of this wildlife photography can kind of bring us into asking these questions and open up this sort of richer imagination about who animals are and how they exist in the world? Or does it, I'm dichotomizing here, but does it sort of then end up fixing the animal in some way under this kind of omnipotent gaze to say, well, you know, here we are, we've cataloged them, slot that into you know, whatever museum or whatever the whatever place, and that's sort of the end of the story. Or is this is there a possibility in the photography itself as a kind of hinge into different relationships with animals that aren't about kind of fixing into place or a particular idea of who they are?
Well, I think it all depends on the photograph, but I also would say that it's kind of both. The effects of a photograph are not simple or straightforward. We come to them and we bring our own baggage with us. And so that, you know, one of the things I did was I traced the circulation of this one photographer's photographs. So he starts out, this is George Schwartz III, he's showing these photographs of flash photographs of deer at night. And he publishes them in the National Geographic. And at the time, he's publishing them as part of this article advocating the practice of camera hunting. But at this stage, he's one of the people who thinks that camera hunting should come to replace rifle hunting, and that, you know, it's a way of having an engagement with the animals that's not about killing. Well, as these photographs recirculate, this issue was very popular. They had to reprint it, and they published some of these photographs as special pull-out supplements to the National Geographic. You could buy them framed. But the images continue to recirculate, and all of a sudden, you know, in the 1960s, you see these images accompanying an article on kinds of activities, recreational activities available in Michigan, as an example of the kind of deer you can hunt with a rifle in Michigan as a sport activity. So it's like, well, the meaning of those images, which did apparently attract a lot of people, got them to engage with the animals, can spur some people to think, wow, I'd really like to shoot those, and spur other people to think those are really beautiful animals, they should not be shot.
Mm-hmm.
There isn't any way, I think, of guaranteeing that the image will function in the way you would hope.
Mm-hmm.
Some people will find in these images something to project onto, so some sort of fantasied relation to animals. Other people will see in them the possibility of opening up a different or deeper relation to animals.
It sounds like a lot of it has to do, I mean, yeah, as you mentioned, it's just incredibly layered about how people will understand the photograph, the baggage that they bring to it, but the context that it's positioned in as well, right? And it circulates in different contexts and different places. I know that this is probably, I'm probably going to be accused of not really fully understanding what you said the way that I'm going to ask this question, but is there certain things, though, that you've seen that people have, photographers have done to try to elicit a certain reaction where they do draw people in further and it's less of an objectifying kind of, where there might be the tendency to do that, to kind of disrupt in the technique itself of the photograph?
Well, I mean, we see some of the, you know, contemporary photographers doing things where, say, they're making the animal less visible in the image as a way of saying, this is, you know, trying to get at the presence of the animal as opposed to just treating it as a form to be depicted. You get other photographers who are, you know, wanting to photograph animals in zoos, but do so in a way that highlights their confinement and the conditions they're in as a way of saying, okay, a good example here is Frank Nolker, trying to capture the sadness of zoos so that these images speak to the animal's conditions and how they're not able to engage. Whereas someone like Volker Sating, taking photographs in zoos, wanted to capture what he thought of as the magic of zoos and as this space. So, you know, we see people coming to photography attempting different things and then their success or failure. So does someone like Bertha Jasinski's very fuzzy photographs of animals, where she's trying to say, well, the animal isn't really accessible to us, and so she's trying to capture more of an aura, their presence. Do those read as really successful in terms of getting people to rethink animals, or do they instead think, well, they're not good photographs?
I know Steve Baker makes a really interesting argument about, I know we're not talking about animal rights photography in particular, but the idea that the goal is really not to try to come up with a new image that will somehow fix the image into the proper way or the good way to read an animal. And that really, that kind of gesture actually undoes the baseline for a lot of people in terms of animal rights or animal liberation, which is to kind of not fix the animal into a particular place and not ascribe this new dogma that everyone has to feel or think, and says to kind of let the animal be more full than that or more rich than just a new prescription for how we are supposed to understand.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Yeah. We only have about 5 more minutes left. We can keep talking about this if you had any last thoughts that you wanted to share, or we could shift into some of your more recent work. I was reading that you're considering now some questions around the use of animal imagery and activist discourse in contemporary art. We could talk about that, or we could, as I said, continue
okay.
on here.
I mean, well, that's a kind of continuation of this of the same questions, which is to say, I mean, there's really interesting work that's been done that's kind of shown that one of the important ways people come into animal activism is through images. Mm. That they see an image that affects them deeply, and that is one of the things that say, okay, this practice is going on, I have to intervene, try and stop it somehow. It's just, and it's different than a lot of other forms of activism where people get brought in through peer networks, through dialogue and discussion. But I guess one of the things that's interested me is that they're in relation to that, then, so animal activism seems to have a very powerful relation to images, that they're important to people in very emotional and powerful ways. And say someone like Jonathan Burtz talked about this, about the way in which animal imagery can undo representational structures and just kind of grab people on a very visceral level.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, you have a whole discourse around contemporary art, and particularly shock art, that treats the public reaction or shock as a sign that the work is actually being effective and provocative. And so one of the things I've been thinking about is that we have these kind of repeating series of outrages coming out of contemporary art in which we get animal activists saying, well, this is just crazy. What's going on here?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things they end up doing then is trying to hold the people accountable by saying, this is this person, they've done something really awful. And one of the things I'm interested in is that in terms of the art world, repeating someone's name over and over again doesn't function as a kind of shaming mechanism, but is in fact saying that they've done something interesting, significant, and important. So it's that conflict to say there's a gap between the two understandings of naming, shaming, responsibility, and the way images function that seems to be set up to use animal activists as a kind of easy trigger to say, I can do something with animals, it will get lots of reaction, and that will make me famous. So that there's the guy here in Toronto doing the cat thing, really awful thing, but all of a sudden his name keeps getting repeated mm-hmm. and repeated, and he becomes somebody that everybody in the Toronto art world then feels they have to have a position on. So he becomes a kind of minor figure within the art world because he's being attacked and criticized. And so at the same time, he did something really awful. And I can, you know, more than empathize with the desire to hold him accountable. So it really leaves us in a kind of bind in terms of saying, well, how do we then engage with these activities within art and suggest that they're not only bad for the animals, but perhaps bad art, in a way that doesn't at the same time suggest, well, they're very effective in terms of powerfully provoking the audience mm-hmm. and indicating some sort of deep issues in the culture, and therefore that they're good art.
Well, Matt, thanks so much for being here.
Well,
it was a real
you.
Pleasure. leaving us with some good things to contemplate. Hopefully we'll have Matt back on maybe once you've looked even more into these issues. We'd love to have you back on the show again. It was really great to have you here.
Well, thank you very much.
You've been listening to Animal Voices, CIUT 89.5 FM. This program will be archived within about a week on our website, animalvoices.ca. You can check it out, download it for free there. Our email address, animalvoices@gmail.com. We'd love it if you wrote to us. If you have any ideas for upcoming shows or any comments on this program, do write to us. Also, we have a Facebook group, so if you'd like to find out what's going on with the program, to get some background information on the show, please do join us at facebook.com. Just key in Animal Voices, and you can join us there. And we always appreciate your vote at podcastalley.com. And as a final word, stay tuned for Dos Mundos. Sergio, coming up. CIUT. Thanks, Carl, for teching.